What was it like to hear about the JFK assassination? Or America's triumph over Hitler? We're seeing Queen at Live Aid. Our past is a collection of stories that bring us to now. Welcome to the Eyewitness History Podcast, where we view history through the eyes of the people that watch the events that shaped our world. Here's your host, Josh Cohen, and these are their stories.
Hello, everyone, and thank you for tuning into this episode of Eyewitness History. This episode, I have the pleasure of speaking with Hugh Fink. During his tenure as a writer for NBC's Saturday Night Live, along Will Ferrell, Maya Rudolph, Norm Macdonald, Tina Fey, and Tracy Morgan, Fink not only earned a reputation for his fearless lampooning of pop culture, but also appeared as a commentator on the show's Weekend Update. During his final season at SNL, Hugh Fink received the Emmy Award for Outstanding Writing for a Comedy Program. Last year, he was brought back to Saturday Night Live as a guest writer to share his expertise with the newer cast members and writers. We discuss a lot. We discuss his time as a writer with SNL. We discuss his part in the infamous Eddie Murphy controversy, as well as his experience writing the last sketch Chris Farley ever appeared in addition to a lot more. And now I give you Hugh Fink. Okay, I'm here with Hugh Fink. Hugh, thanks for coming on the podcast.
Good to be here, Josh.
My pleasure. There's so much I want to discuss with you, Hugh. I want to discuss your relationship with Rodney Dangerfield, your work at Saturday Night Live, certainly, your collaborations with David Spade, and of course, the late, great Norm Macdonald. I also want to discuss what the day-to-day life of an SNL writer is like. I think our audience would be very pleased to get some of the behind-the-scenes information there. But before we get there, Hugh, please tell our listeners briefly sort of who you are and what you do.
I'm a comedian and television writer-producer. I started as a stand-up comedian, ended up headlining clubs, colleges, doing a lot of television as a comedian. Then I made the transition to being a comedy writer for television. And after my career writing for television, I became a showrunner slash producer, executive producer. So at any point when I wake up in the morning, I don't know which of those things I'll be doing. Stand-up, writing, producing, or all three. But it's all comedy, and it's what's kept me going for many years.
Excellent. So when did you decide that comedy was for you, and how exactly did you get your start?
At an age so young, I can't remember, Josh, how long. But I always was gifted at being funny and making people laugh and writing funny things. And so coming out of high school, at that time, it wasn't really a clear-cut thing to become a comedian or a comedy writer. So I went into an prestigious acting program at a university, but realized very quickly that was not it because they were kind of humorless. So I had to pivot from studying acting, but I did end up fairly quickly becoming a comedian.
So then that's a great springboard then to my next question, Hugh. How did you meet Rodney Dangerfield and what was he like off camera?
I met him because a mutual friend of mine, a comedian named Bob Zaney, who's still to this day a traveling headlining comedian, was approached by Rodney to help him find the next great young comedians for Rodney's HBO specials, which he did every several years. They had launched everybody from the late Bob Saget, who was a friend of mine, Sam Kinison, Roseanne Barr, Andrew Dice Clay. You know, these were huge comedians for their time. And they got their launch on Rodney's special. So Bob Zaney had Rodney come see me at a club in L.A., and he really dug me, but he came to see me three times before deciding that I'd be one of the comedians to be on his HBO Young Comedian special. So we became friends. He was a mentor to me. I loved Rodney.
You said on another podcast recently, Hugh, that behind the scenes, Rodney was actually a little bit of a grump.
I'd say a little more than a little bit of a grump. He was definitely a grump, not towards me personally, although one time, well, you know, I asked him for his advice after I taped my special with him. And I said, so what do you think, like, I do next? He goes, here's the deal, man. Go to HBO. Tell them you want your own special. If they say no, fuck them. That was his advice. Like, okay, Rodney, thanks. I guess you being Rodney Dangerfield, movie and TV star, could get away with that. I, Hugh Fink, probably can't, but appreciate your advice. But yes, he was a grouch. I think the reason he was grumpy is because he didn't have success till much later in his career.
Right.
So he faced a lot of rejection, a lot of idiots telling him what he should and shouldn't do with his career. But through his own ingenuity and talent, he broke through. By the time he became successful, he had a lot of resentment and anger toward the journey. So I think that explains some of his grumpiness.
Yeah, I believe he was an aluminum siding salesman to hitting peak comedy for, as far as I can tell, on the Johnny Carson show. Can you recall the last time you saw him, Hugh?
I can. He came to Saturday Night Live when I was a writer there to visit Molly Shannon, who, of course, is a huge actress now.
Sure.
He was thinking of her. I think he was thinking of casting her in some movie he was doing. So he let me know ahead of time that he was coming and gave me a big hug. I introduced them around the show to some of my friends who, you know, cast members and writers. And that was the last time I saw him. And he was so nice because he was older. His health was declining, but he was good enough to come to New York and hang out.
Sure. I feel like I have to ask. I have my own favorite Rodney Dangerfield joke. Do you have one?
I actually do. What's yours?
So mine is, I told my psychiatrist I've been feeling suicidal. He says from now on, I have to pay in advance.
Yes. That's an old joke from the Borscht Belt, which Rodney updated. My favorite Rodney joke was, hey, I tell you, my wife is so stupid, it takes her an hour and a half to watch 60 minutes.
I think it was in a podcast last year. You said that the first joke you wrote that ever made it to air, make sure I have this right, was for Dennis Miller and his HBO talk show. What was that experience like? What's the experience of, like, I guess, was it a situation where he asked you to write a joke and you effectively sold it to him? What was it like?
Sort of. One of his writers reached out to me and said, hey, Dennis is always looking for new joke writers and you're a good joke writer. If you want, you can send in some jokes, and if he uses any of them, we'll pay for the ones he uses. So the cool thing about that process was I sent in, I don't know, maybe 6 or 7 jokes, and no one said anything to me. And then I watched the show live, sort of like Saturday Night Live. That show was broadcast live. So I'm watching it in real time, and the show always opens with Dennis standing to camera and doing a joke before the credits even roll. And he did my joke to start the show off.
Wow.
So that was thrilling because no one had given me heads up that he was going to do that. And then I ended up maybe a few weeks later going to a taping of the show. And Dennis said, hey, man, your joke was great. So that was a real boost of confidence.
Yeah, absolutely. One question I do want to ask, and I suspect there's no real answer to this as such, but I'd love to just hear your process on it. What would you say, Hugh, makes up a good joke versus a bad joke?
Well, this may sound silly, but a good joke has to be something that most people get, meaning that it's constructed in a way where you hear the punchline and don't go, wait, I think I understand what's funny about that. So it's got to be communicate the humor. Secondly, I'd say a good joke versus a bad joke is something that's not predictable. If you sort of see the punchline coming or you hear the joke and laugh and go, oh, yeah, I had thought of that myself. To me, that's not as good as a punchline that completely shocks you, surprises you, takes you off guard. There's an originality to that type of thought.
Sure.
And then the third thing would be if it's a joke that you can repeat to somebody else and it still gets a laugh. Well, that's the sign of a great joke, because then it's not even just about the person delivering the joke. It's about the writing of the joke itself that's so solid, any normal person could tell it and elicit a laugh.
Yeah. So simple and yet so difficult. So then, yeah, Hugh, what was it that brought you then to Saturday Night Live?
My relationship with David Spade, pretty much, because David and I were comedians who started in LA around the same time, and we became friends, and we had a similar sensibility about the world and pop culture and making fun of celebrities. So David was a star on the rise at Saturday Night Live, and he said, I really think you'd be a great writer here. So it took him a little while, but he made it happen, which was amazing.
Yeah. Speaking on David Spade, I know you collaborated with him on the infamous Eddie Murphy joke. that he told in the Hollywood Minute. Maybe you can briefly run through that joke for our audience. And I'd love to know if you can recall writing that joke and if you were surprised by Eddie Murphy's reaction. So just those 9 questions for you.
Sure. So Spade did a celebrated segment called Hollywood Minute, where he would make fun of celebrities, which, believe it or not, at the time, not that many comedians would do because they were afraid of comedians hurting their careers. But David was pretty fearless. So we did Hollywood Minute together. Spade wrote a lot of great jokes himself. I wrote jokes he liked, he'd use. So we were doing a Christmas show, meaning it was the last Saturday Night Live before the holidays. And Eddie Murphy's movie, Vampire in Brooklyn, had just come out and bombed. I didn't see it, but I heard it sucked and it didn't do well. And keep in mind, Eddie Murphy had coincidentally been a cast member on Saturday Night Live before David Spade or I worked there. So David comes out and does this joke, which was, if I recall correctly, he showed a poster. We showed a poster of the movie Vampire in Brooklyn. And David looked at the camera and said, "Look, kids, a falling star. Make a wish," which got a mixture of groans and laughter and applause. It was very mixed reaction. But I think the reason people really took offense was they thought it was mean for David to do a joke about this famous Saturday Night Live cast member, because that's where Eddie got his start, right? And so considered mean and unthinkable that a current cast member would make fun of Eddie. But David did. When you asked me about the reaction, I certainly could never have predicted how Eddie Murphy would react to hearing the joke. I would bet that he wouldn't like it, for sure. But I couldn't predict how Eddie was going to react. I knew that he wouldn't like the joke, but I didn't necessarily think he would go public in his anger about the joke. So David does the joke and the audience gets a mixed reaction. Then Monday morning, I'm at 30 Rockefeller Center. I don't think Spade had arrived at the office yet. And I'd been tipped off that Eddie Murphy had called NBC a few times wanting to speak to Spade. And I'm like, oh boy, I can only imagine why he's calling. Well, Spade shows up to the office and hears that Eddie's been calling, and David's not happy about that because David doesn't want a confrontation with Eddie Murphy. But Eddie finally gets him on the phone and just reads him the riot act, tells him how you disrespected me. How dare you? You're not funny. I made Saturday Night Live, and really threatened him in anger. And this went on for years, that David Spade and Eddie Murphy were not friends, certainly. And Eddie would let people know how he hated Spade. He also refused to ever come to Saturday Night Live as a guest host or a guest appearance. I don't think the only reason was because of Spade's joke, but the joke didn't help. And it took years later, they somehow came to terms with it. I don't know if David apologized or how it happened, but Eddie finally sort of, quote unquote, forgave him for the joke.
It's extraordinary. It's a shame, too, because one would think, obviously, not having met Eddie Murphy, one would think he'd be would take it in good spirit and recognize, hey, I'm a public figure. All is fair in love and comedy.
I agree. And I think what makes it particularly disappointing is Eddie did a lot of viciously mean jokes about celebrity when he was a comedian. You know, his old specials, making fun of Mr. T, ridiculing Bill Cosby. Exactly. Yeah. Doing gay jokes about people. And again, that's all stuff that comedians should be allowed to do. But somehow when it came to his own image, he had a very, very thin skin.
Oh, bummer. So I'd love to know, getting back to Saturday Night Live itself, Hugh, what was the behind the scenes process like for a writer ideating a sketch and actually getting it on the air?
It's a very challenging, stressful process that starts over every single week that you have a new episode. And it really starts Monday when the guest host comes and meets with the writing staff on Monday night, and they exchange some ideas. Then between Tuesday and Wednesday, the writers submit all their sketches for the week, which is averages around 40 sketches. Now keep in mind, the only number of sketches that airs in a given episode might be 10 to 12, if that. So most people's sketches are not getting picked. And it's really competitive. And on Wednesday night, they pick the sketches for the weekend. And then Thursday and Friday, they rehearse those sketches that are going to be on. And then Saturday, early evening, there's a dress rehearsal, which is done just like an actual live show. But what happens is they do more sketches than they need at the dress rehearsal and end up cutting about 15 minutes worth of material. So even until a few minutes before Saturday night, the live show, you don't necessarily know if your sketch has made it or not.
That's incredible. Can you recall a sketch that you really enjoyed writing that you thought would hit that didn't make it to air?
Oh, there were many, for sure. I mean, any writer who's there as long as I have would say the same. Well, one sketch that I had hoped to make it to air but realized it wasn't going to was the infamous 9/11 show. It was the first Saturday Night Live after 9/11.
Mm-hmm.
I was a writer there, and I wrote a sketch for Will Ferrell where he played Cat Stevens, the singer, a.k.a. Yusuf Islam. And the joke, Josh, was that I took Cat Stevens' greatest hits and changed all the lyrics to be about terrorism. And Will was dressed as a Muslim sheikh, like Cat Stevens appears now, long beard and a turban. And he's singing these songs related to 9/11, which, of course, is granted very dark.
Right.
That's a humor. And Will did a hilarious impression. He sounded just like Cat Stevens. And the sketch was good enough to get picked. Like I described, it got picked at the table read. But by Saturday, I was hearing grumblings that NBC was not happy with the sketch. They thought that it was defaming Cat Stevens' reputation, and it ended up getting cut. So that was a bummer.
Yeah. I'm curious what the, see how I phrase this. I'm curious what the emotional experience of having a sketch get cut is. Is it like, you know, the sketch is cut and then you think, oh, shoot, now my head is just a little bit more on that potential chopping block? Because I imagine it's a bit of a churn and burn with an environment as competitive as that.
It's depressing when your sketch is cut. It really is. I don't know if it's more depressing to have your sketch cut at dress rehearsal or to come out of the table read on Wednesday having nothing in the show. That's really demoralizing when you have nothing for the week that you've written on the air.
Yeah.
But I would maybe compare having your sketch cut at dress rehearsal to an athlete who's in the playoffs, right? Trying to make it to the World Series and their team loses so they don't advance to the final round. Maybe that's a good comparison.
Yeah, I'd agree. I would love to know, what was your relationship with the late, great Norm Macdonald like? One of my favorite comedians ever.
Oh, that's cool. We had a good relationship. We weren't friends who socialized. We were friendly and made each other laugh and had a really good trust and respect for each other. So Norm knew me as a comedian. I knew him as a comic. We ended up both at Saturday Night Live. And I think where I really won Norm over was when I convinced him that he could do the best Larry King impression of all time. And I went out and wrote Larry King's News and Views, which, you know, we did 3 or 4 times. And I think to this day is the best Larry King impression ever. And it had a really original angle to making fun of Larry King. And Norm loved doing it. He loved it. And the story I heard recently, Josh, is that Johnny Carson told Norm that he loved the Larry King bit.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, Johnny had seen it and thought it was hilarious.
That's incredible. Well, it's funny. You mentioned that you have a sense of dark humor. By odd coincidence, I kind of do as well. And one of my favorite lines from Norm Macdonald, as we know, he sadly passed of cancer. And he said, well, I didn't really lose a battle with cancer, because when I die, the cancer dies too. That's kind of a draw.
That's right. Making fun of the word battle.
Yeah.
I also worked with Norm on one of his really famous bit, the ESPY Awards for ESPN, which he hosted and I produced and was head writer. And that was a famous ESPYs. Because of what we did on the air, the ESPYs changed their whole approach to comedy because they thought that it was way too mean and controversial. But it went over huge to the audience. And Will Ferrell came on as the late Harry Carey, the Chicago
Cubs
announcer, and did a bit with Norm where he just made fun of all the famous athletes in the house. I mean, everybody was there. I'm saying Tiger Woods and Michael Jordan. I mean, it was huge. Norm was brilliant. And the jokes that we did for him in the ESPY Awards were unforgettable.
Yeah, absolutely. I know the clip that you're referring to. He's pure unfiltered Norm Macdonald in that.
He is. And again, it was all scripted. You know, that's all on teleprompter. But Norm was a master stand-up and could deliver the material seamlessly and with confidence, and he didn't care.
Yeah, for my money, delivery and timing, it's got to be Rodney and Norm. I think are probably the two best I've ever seen. Actually, oftentimes, in my opinion, you can see Norm even sort of channeling Rodney. You know, he says, and then I say, and then he says.
Right.
I'd love to know then, Hugh, what was it like working with Chris Farley and writing that El Nino sketch?
I loved working with Chris. I only worked with him at Saturday Night Live that time when he came back to host, right? Because he had left the show. But I was friendly with Chris through David Spade. They were great buddies. And I did a couple projects with Chris and David to promote their movie Black Sheep. Mm-hmm. So when Farley would come to LA, I'd sometimes hang with him. When Farley would come to Los Angeles, I'd hang out with him. And I'd see him in New York sometimes. And we got along great. He liked when I made fun of Spade. That was his favorite thing, because he and Spade had that type of friendship where they totally busted on each other. As a friend of Spade's, I'd bust on him. And Farley loved when I would make fun of Spade. So it was a huge loss for those of us who knew Chris and worked with him. You know, was it a loss that was shocking? Sadly, I can't say that. But still so young, and he was 33.
Yeah.
And he had so much left as a great actor, performer to give.
Yeah, it's true. You know, there are some people that the humor sort of like permeates off of them to the point where they could almost be standing still, not doing anything, and they'll make you laugh. There's a few of them for me. Tim Conway's one. I would say Larry David and Chris Farley as well.
Yeah, that's a good analysis. I think Farley had that gift where before he even opens his mouth, you like him and want to laugh.
Yeah. So then for the El Nino sketch, I'm just curious about the experience of writing that. I'm specifically curious about that brilliant pause that he takes. Did you write that pause, Hugh?
Do you mean of the Nino?
Yes. Yeah. Sorry. Yeah. So for our audience, well, perhaps you can give a little context on the joke and go from there.
Sure. So one of the pop culture phenomenons at the time Chris hosted the show was, there was this weather front. I don't know if you call it a hurricane or but it was called El Nino. And the whole world was talking about how it was going to devastate the world. The Weather Channel was covering El Nino nonstop. So I decided, how hilarious would it be if Chris Farley played the weather front El Nino? And the way he would do that is as a championship wrestler named El Nino. So the line that I wrote, that was actually one of the first jokes I came up with for the whole sketch, that I think is the most memorable line, is he goes, "For those of you who don't know, El Nino is a Spanish word meaning the Nino." That's always was the impetus for the sketch. I don't recall whether I had to coach Chris on how to say it. I think that it was pretty clear based on how I put it in the script, how to say it. And he did. And he was a guy who would very much be open to taking notes. So if he was saying it in dress rehearsal in a way that I didn't want, I definitely would have told him, "Hey, Chris, you need to say it like this," because he was very respectful of writers.
Mm.
But it's really cool that I happened to write the last sketch Farley ever did on the show.
Yeah, that's extraordinary. Do you remember the last time you saw him, Hugh?
Well, sure. It was that night. And I remember at the party afterwards, I gave him a big hug and said, "Chris, El Nino was genius. You're great." He just, in Chris's typical way, he's very much wanting to please his family and friends. He's like, "Did I do good, Hugh? Did I do good?" I said, "Chris, you did better than good. You were amazing."
Yeah, he was. I'm curious. I know I asked you about a sketch that you wrote that didn't make it to air. I'd love to know if you have a favorite sketch you wrote that did make it to air.
There's a few. I think as time's gone on, one of my favorites is my sketch called Stevie Nicks Fajita Roundup. In which, if you remember Lucy Lawless, the actress who starred as Xena Warrior Princess, she plays Stevie Nicks, the Fleetwood Mac lead singer, who's now operating a lowbrow, cheap Mexican restaurant in Sedona, Arizona, called Stevie Nicks Fajita Roundup. So it's a local commercial in Arizona for this cheap, horrible Mexican restaurant. But similar to the technique I did with the Will Ferrell Cat Stevens sketch, I took Fleetwood Mac's greatest hits and Stevie Nicks' greatest hits and had her sing songs, but the lyrics were all about tacos and Mexican food. And the sketch went over very well, but as time's gone on, it's got a cult following. The Ringer, you know, the famous website that does pop culture, they called me a year ago and were doing a story about how huge this sketch remains among fans of Saturday Night Live. So they did a whole profile on it. Wow. But I think it's really cool that the sketch has affected people that way.
Yeah, that's wonderful, Hugh. You know, let me ask this, Hugh. If you already answered it, just tell me and I'll move on. But I've certainly heard many people talk about the competitive atmosphere on SNL. You just a few moments ago, I know Julia Louis-Dreyfus didn't have the best time there. You know, I could go on. How would you describe the culture at Saturday Night Live?
And let me just say for the record, I had a much better time than Julia did. He's talked about how she really didn't like it at all. Right. I, you know, love my time there, but yes, it was filled with competitiveness and tension. So tell me again what to address.
Yeah, just if you had any additional notes as far as what the culture was like at Saturday Night Live.
Oh, yes. So the culture is the cast members who become stars oftentimes are very respectful and dependent upon the writers, which is interesting because on a lot of projects, that's not true. So the cast, they don't kiss up to the writers, but they're very, very nice and respectful to the writers because they need the writers to get on the air. So that's one interesting part of the culture. The other is that there's sort of friendly divisiveness between people of different comedy backgrounds, meaning the comedians who end up on the show, like me, Norm Macdonald, Colin Quinn, David Spade, we have a very different approach to comedy than, say, people who come from Upright Citizens Brigade or the Groundlings improv troupe. Then you've got a third sect, which is I would call the Harvard Lampoon writers. And they're the type of writers who maybe literally wrote for the Harvard Lampoon or came from universities where they've never performed, they've never set foot on stage as performers, but they're funny writers. So those three groups can clash and be competitive about what they think is funny and the type of stuff they write.
Interesting. That's very interesting. But yeah, I was thinking as you were talking, Conan O'Brien, filling the ladder.
Totally.
Yeah.
Harvard Lampoon.
Yep. So just have a couple questions left, Hugh, and I really appreciate you taking the time here. I'm curious if you have any advice for a comedy writer looking to get started at SNL specifically. What advice would you give them?
I'll give you, Josh, the same advice that I'm giving currently. I've been approached to be teaching sketch comedy writing at top universities, their film and TV departments. So taught at Harvard this summer.
Oh.
And I'm teaching at Chapman University, the School of Cinematic Arts, and Cal State Northridge this fall. Oh. So I have actual college students for credit, film and TV majors, studying writing for sketch television. So what I tell them is write in your original voice. In other words, if you write stuff that's funny but sounds like other writers, that's not going to be as powerful as writing stuff that only you could write. For example, for better or worse, no one else is going to do Stevie Nicks Fajita Roundup, right? Like that came from my mind.
Right.
Secondly, I would say know your audience, meaning if Saturday Night Live is the show you want to write for, well, you got to understand there's certain types of jokes or concepts that probably aren't going to work well on that show. Maybe that's your idea is better for Key and Peele or Tim Robinson's I Think You Should Leave or some other sketch project. So you have to know your audience. That's true with being a comedian. That's true with being a comedy writer. And the third thing I would say is you have to have a really, really thick skin because you're going to face a lot of rejection. You'll face rejection before you get the job. You'll face rejection while you have the job. And some people, as talented as they are, aren't cut out to sort of face that rejection, but it simply comes with the territory.
Yeah. Beautiful. Hugh Fink, how can people find out about you, sir?
Easiest way, go to hughfink.com, hughfink.com. It's my website. That's where I post. Sometimes I'm doing workshops in comedy writing, stand-up comedy. It's where I'll post career news. I'll put clips of recent stuff that I've written or produced for television. That's the best way.
Beautiful. Hugh, thank you so much for taking the time for me. This was a real pleasure. I appreciate it.
Oh, thank you, Josh. It's nice to talk with someone who's done their homework.
Oh, hey, I try my best. I appreciate it. I'm glad it showed. Excellent, Hugh. Well, you enjoy the rest of your day, okay?
You got it.
All right. Thank you, sir.
Thanks a lot.
Bye.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to this episode. For more information on Eyewitness History, along with show notes and links to resources, go to ParthenonPodcast.com, where you can also listen to some other great podcasts by the Parthenon Network, such as Scott Rank's History Unplugged, Steve Guerra's Beyond the Big Screen, and James Early's Key Battles of American History, along with many others. Thank you.
The Historical Jesus Podcast is the sweeping saga of the life and times of Galilean Jesus of Nazareth, as well as the faith, religion, and church founded to honor and disseminate his acts and teachings. Join me, Mark Vinette, on this fascinating journey through time, exploring the many great works of Christian theology, literature, architecture, music, and art, inspired by the words and deeds of Jesus Christ.